Welcome back to Radio Times. We're speaking with Michael Mack, whose one-man play, Hearing Voices Speaking in Tongues, about his mother's schizophrenia, is being performed at the Philadelphia Fringe Festival. We just had a caller, David Michael, who was just asking us about how mental health professionals dealt with your mother. And stigma.
Well, I think that there has been a tremendous evolution in the way that mental health care is provided in the last 30 or 40 years since my mother first became ill. I'm not sure. The question was around stigma and related to clinicians. I think that clinicians have always been as helpful as they could be, helping a person to get through stigma. But the stigma of mental illness has been around for centuries. I had the experience when I was younger, a young man, and I was riding with a friend, a roommate, in the car. And at one point, I just kind of blurted out about my mother's condition. And I said that she had stayed in state hospitals. And he turned to me with this slow and dangerous look and said, "What did you say?" And I said, "My mom. She's spent time in state mental hospitals." And he turned back and he said, "Oh, I thought you said that you were in mental hospitals. I was going to tell you to get out of the car." So that's just an example of just how deeply rooted stigma can be.
Yeah. David, thanks for calling. You know, one of your poems talks about an incident very early in your childhood where your mom is, I think, clutching you as you're getting on a school bus. And actually, as you get on the bus, she's sort of clutching at the window. And when you get on, a friend of yours says, "Who was that man who was crying there?" And your response is, "I don't know him." That you had to face this issue of how you dealt with, I guess, what was an increasingly kind of public displays of your mom's illness.
That's true. I denied her three times, as it turned out, in that moment. But I felt a tremendous amount of shame for the way that she was acting. I also felt, as a lot of kids in similar situations feel, is guilt, feeling that they are somehow responsible for their mother's or their parents' illness. That was one of the touching things to read in that article in the Inquirer that I referred to a little bit earlier, is how kids felt that they were the cause of it somehow.
Kids feel that they're responsible for their parents' divorce and for their mental illness.
Yes.
And if I could just, yes. I was just the right kid, right? Yeah. Your mom was in and out of hospitals for much of that period after when you were five, right? And
that's
at
right.
times you would stay with some neighbors, the Kramers, right?
Mm-hmm.
You said there just became a rhythm of her being in the hospital and out of the hospital.
That's right. And in fact, there was this this one time, my sister has this memory, of the four of us kids sitting on the sofa watching TV one night, and my mother comes in, my father bringing her home from the hospital. And all four of us kids just kept looking at the TV.
It wasn't an event anymore, right?
It wasn't an event. And my mother got a little bit annoyed. She said, "Well, aren't you even going to go say hello to your mother?" And so we get up, and we go over to her, and we give her a hug. And then we go right back to the sofa and continue watching TV. So it had become the normal flow of things that she was in, and she was out, and she was back in again.
And did your friends know and understand that your mom had this problem, or were you constantly hiding it or avoiding it or talking around it? Or?
I think what we did was what most folks back in those times and in that situation did, which was to not talk about it. And even within the family, folks were reluctant to talk about it.
That's interesting. Your dad didn't talk to you about it?
Well, I would ask him. I have these very clear memories, especially when we were going to visit her in the state hospital when I was in my early teens, when I was 12 or 13. And it was a long drive, and he went every 2 weeks to visit her. And I would accompany him. And the trip there would be one that for me was nerve-wracking, and my father was kind of silent and seemed edgy. And
nerve-wracking because you didn't know what to expect when you saw her.
I didn't know exactly. I mean, none of us knew what it was going to be like.
Which mom would be there.
Right. And almost invariably, after we visited in the return home, I would ask my father how she ended up going to the hospital like that. And he would begin, it's his way to do this, he would begin at the very beginning, which is the night they first met, way back when in Washington, D.C., and he would tell me the whole story. And that was a two-hour trip from the
medical. How did he relate their courtship to this illness?
Well, it was, I don't think that he was consciously making a relationship between the courtship and her illness, but he was just starting from the very beginning as he knew it.
It was a narrative. Right, yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
And so, in a way, I'm carrying on his spirit by telling this narrative.
Michael Mack is with us, the author of The One-Man Play, Speaking in Hearing Voices, Speaking in Tongues. If you'd like to call, we have a few lines open. The number's 1-888-477-WHYY. Alan is with us from Chester County. Are you there, Alan?
Yes.
Yeah, thanks for waiting.
And thank you for the program. I'm enjoying it as a catharsis, just listening to this. And our situation, I say our because my younger sister and I were, and my father were involved in almost the same blueprint with our mother. And
was that when you were a young child, Alan?
Yes. It's one of the reasons why I called, because my sister and I get together, we reflect and try to find out the onset of mom's illness. And we can't seem to detect, as one could with a physical malady, when it occurred. And there were signs of aberrations as far as diet and eating, and we don't know if that was the onset of it, and that led to other things. Over the years, the behavior of my mom was getting worse, and she eventually was hospitalized periodically and received shock treatment, psychotherapy. And all this time, she was a wonderful mother, a very caring, devoted person, and it really never affected her. The illness never affected her caring for us. So that kind of masqueraded to an extent the severity of the disease. And, you know, even to this day, I'm in my 60s, and I have trouble talking about the stigma. It's only to a few people that I can really say it.
And it sounds like you and your sister still want an explanation. Why could this happen to this woman who loved us so?
Yeah, we talk about it, I think, every time we see each other. Not in the same state, but when we do see each other talk, it always comes into the conversation, because it was such a salient thing with us, our mother's illness. It was just interwoven with our everyday lives.
Right.
And what your guest, Michael, says about his father suffering it. Same thing with our father, and didn't realize until latter days of her illness how much he endured and what a superhuman effort he put in to stay with the family. And I still reflect and try to figure out how he was able to do that and keep the family going. It's remarkable.
Okay, thank you for calling out.
You're welcome.
This is not an uncommon experience.
That's true. Alan used the phrase superhuman effort. And a little bit earlier, Dave, you had you were mentioning how much kids needed an anchor, a rock, especially in a very tumultuous time. And my father was that anchor. And again, it wasn't until I started writing about it and thinking about it that I realized just what a tremendous effort he put out for my mother's benefit and for our benefit as kids. I can't thank him enough.
Yeah. Hard to have realized at the time quite what he was going through, I guess. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. You know, as I've looked at the video with parts of the performance on it, one of the things that struck me about it is that it is very intense, hard-edged, a lot of pain there. And I'm wondering if you are ever able to laugh about any of this experience, you and your brothers and sisters. I mean, are there moments that are tender or that allow you to sort of let go of the pain for a moment?
Absolutely, absolutely. And in fact, the course of the show mirrors the course of my mother's illness and our lives. The most intense part of the show is the beginning, and over the course of the show, it ranges through all of the emotions, through poignancy, through lightheartedness, through joy, and ultimately through a real, well, again, if I could use the word redemption.
How did the redemption, where do you find redemption in the story?
Well, part of it is informed by the fact that we were raised Roman Catholic. And when my mother first became ill, she took on the symbolism of the church, the iconography, and it very much, her illness manifested those symbols. So, for example, she might think that my father was God, or at some other time might think that he was Satan, or that the child that she had just given birth to, my younger sister, was the baby Jesus. And all throughout her life, this iconography figured. So it seemed only fitting that this theme interweaved throughout the show, and in fact ultimately to be the climax of it.
Michael Mack is with us. If you'd like to call, we have a few lines open. The number is 1-888-477-WHYY. That's 1-888-477-9499. Yeah, you mentioned your mother in some of the cases where your mother would grab her rosary and ask you to pray for her.
Yes, yes.
Was she praying for treatment for the illness or for release from these demons? Was it?
I think that that was it. It was. She tried a number of different self-medicating ways to try and free herself of this. And I think that she was desperate in the same way that my father was desperate, although differently. She was desperate to find some release from the torment that she was experiencing. And it seemed that religion, since she was herself raised Catholic, it seemed like the first place to turn was to ask for some kind of divine guidance. And in fact, some of the early experiences that she had, the delusions or hallucinations that she had, were visitations by otherworldly beings. So if she heard voices, or she was visited, for example, on a bus by an angelic being who gave her cryptic messages, then it seemed to only reinforce or accent the importance, the religious and mystical importance to what she was going through.
I'm curious how you regard some of the other popular kind of presentations of schizophrenia. Probably the best known is the movie A Beautiful Mind by John Nash.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have mixed feelings. I'll start by saying that I think that the movie is tremendously successful in a couple of ways. First of all, in presenting a main character as a person with schizophrenia, and presenting this person with dignity and compassion and real insight. Also, there's something else that they do in the film. They use a device that I think is extremely effective in inviting the audience into the main character's, John Nash's, delusion. And it's only about halfway or maybe partway into the film that the audience realize that they've been fooled. That
right.
That's all I'll say.
Much of this isn't real.
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
Right.
I was a little bit less taken with the ending of the movie, which was more of a Hollywood ending, and the relationship between John and Alicia Nash was it seemed to me a Hollywood relationship, and really didn't contain the complexities that a relationship like that must have, and that in fact was expanded on much more in depth in the book A Beautiful Mind,
right.
Because you can imagine that if one partner is behaving wildly and erratically, then the other partner must be having some serious reservations about being with that person.
Right.
So ultimately, he wins the Nobel Prize, and that's cool. But most folks experience recovery without winning a Nobel Prize, but their recovery is just as important and just as profound.
Right. Lisa from Doylestown, are you there with us?
Yes,
we got just a minute left, if you could make it brief.
Sure. I grew up with a mother very similar, and my question is about the fact of, I just turned the age that she was when her disease really started taking hold. And have you found yourself having any fears about developing it yourself?
Good question.
That is a wonderful question, Lisa. And the answer is yes. And in fact, my brother and my two sisters have experienced this as well.
The fear, not the illness, right.
Exactly. From a very early age. And just speaking for myself, from a very early age, I became afraid that I too would be afflicted in this way. And especially as I went through my teens and my young adulthood, which is really the window when schizophrenia strikes, late teens through late 20s, I felt like there was this shadow over me, this possibility that I might get sick too.
And hopefully that's beyond us now. Lisa, thanks for calling. In just the little time we have left, I want to ask you, Michael Mack, this performance has been such an important part of your life. Can you imagine a point in which you wouldn't do it again, in which you wouldn't be performing this play?
I can't imagine that. One of the reasons why I can't imagine it is because it is still in a state of evolution. And each time I perform it a little bit differently. But more importantly, now that my mother is gone, now that my mother is no longer with us, it is a way of keeping her story and her memory alive.
Michael Mack is the author of Hearing Voices Speaking in Tongues, Sunday and Monday at the Philadelphia Fringe Festival. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you, Dave.
Our engineers today were Scott Williams and Al Banks. Debbie Builder is associate producer of the show. Alan Tu and Susan Greenbaum are senior producers. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Marty Moscowane. Thanks for listening. And you are listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia.